cops go home!
Dozens of protesters at Cal Poly Humboldt barricaded themselves inside a building last night, demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Riot police tried to intervene, but they were eventually called off after failing to stop the demonstration. That campus is now closed through tomorrow at least. It's just one of many protests on college campuses across the country. Yale, UC Berkeley, USC, NYU, Columbia, which has been the epicenter of the protests, and there, more than 100 people were arrested last week. Classes are now hybrid, online, in person for the rest of the semester. The tumult on American campuses and the war in the Middle East in Gaza is weighing on the minds of many Jewish and Muslim people here in Los Angeles. Last night was the start of Passover, which celebrates freedom from bondage and commemorates the exodus of Jews from Egypt. And Ramadan, the month in the Islamic calendar that emphasizes fasting and reflection, ended 2 weeks ago. Yesterday, I spoke with two members from the local faith community to talk about these campus protests in the context of the annual celebrations of Passover and Ramadan. Imam Jihad Turk is founding president of the Bayan Islamic Graduate School, and Rabbi Sarah Horonsky of Temple Beth Hillel in Valley Village. And I began by asking Rabbi Horonsky if this year's Passover feels different.
It most certainly will feel very different this year. I actually reserved a seat for a hostage at our Seder table this year. We'll share this person's story, and where you will also have a flower on our Seder plate as a symbol of believing Jewish women when they share their narratives and their stories.
And what are you referring to specifically?
We have a women's movement that says to believe women when they say that they have been raped or they have been abused. And so many women have recounted this horrific act happening to them on October 7th. And they're having to repeat their story over and over and over again in order to be believed.
Mm. Imam Turk, same question. Did Ramadan mean something different to you this year?
Yes, it most certainly did as well. And Ramadan is a time of reflection, self-restraint. We abstain from eating and drinking anything during daylight hours for 30 days in a row. And in part, that's to help us be more sensitive to those who are without food and clean water around the world. And watching the images on our social media and news outlets that show people starving to death in Gaza and other places around the world makes us a little bit more sensitive to that. And usually at the end of the month of Ramadan, it's a time of great joy and celebration. And this year it was tempered a little bit by the ongoing injustice that we see happening in Gaza in particular, but also other places around the world, including places like Darfur and Sudan.
Mm-hmm. And how are you viewing the increasing passion, shall we say, the increasing tenor of the protests that are happening on college campuses?
Oftentimes, young people are ahead of the rest of the conscious of the society in moving us in a direction that hopefully brings about a more just and civil world and better policies that, you know, domestically and internationally that reflect those values. Looking at the activists on campus, you see that it's quite a broad coalition, primarily of young people who are leading the charge, but it's not a divide religiously, because we see a lot of Jewish activists, Jewish Voices for Peace, and others that are in many ways leading the charge for change in policy and divestment from those who are profiting from violence.
Mm-hmm. How do you see it, Rabbi Horonsky?
I know that 73% of our Jewish college students surveyed have experienced and witnessed forms of anti-Semitism, and we have almost 50% of non-Jewish students reporting the same since October 7th. This is a phenomenal increase, and we have many, many students who don't feel safe living their Jewish life, whether they're wearing a Jewish star, whether they have a mezuzah on their door, and they genuinely are fearing their safety on their campuses, where they, just like every other student, should have a right to be at school to learn and to grow their minds and to expand their minds. I think it's important that our campuses be a safe place for all individuals.
But are you linking these forms of anti-Semitism and the feelings of safety or lack thereof? Are you linking that to the campus activism? Are you saying that they are twinned? They go together?
They're often coming hand in hand. It can be as simple as somebody walking through campus and giving a slur against somebody who is identifiably Jewish, or as they're fearful of going to class. I know my own daughter had was told to either walk out of class in protest or fear retribution for not walking out.
Imam Turk said that, you know, there are Jewish students also protesting and that there is interfaith cooperation when it comes to these campus protests. So do you, Rabbi, do you see any common ground when it comes to the campus protests?
So I would say that there are Jews that are participating because Jews are a very diverse group across a wide swath. And so that doesn't represent the overall Jewish population. I have reminded my congregation that we are to not become so brokenhearted that our hearts get stiff like the Pharaoh's heart was stiff. He lacked empathy. He lacked compassion. And actually, we should be remembering all who are oppressed in this season, all who are suffering, and sharing each other's pain. We can hold multiple truths, and we can hold tightly to one another as we hold our truths. We can recognize the suffering of all people, and we can build coalitions within that.
Imam Turk, you served on the USC President's Advisory Committee on Muslim Life, and the entire committee, including you, resigned on Friday over the cancellation of Asna Tabassum's speech. She was chosen as the USC valedictorian. And can you talk a little bit more about that, why you resigned?
Yeah, we were convened last academic year to advise the president on ways to ensure that Muslim presence on USC's campus was honored and respected, and that the Muslim students also felt safe. And we were wrapping up our work when the valedictorian, her valedictory speech was rescinded, the honor of giving that speech. And so we met with the provost. He suggested it was entirely a security-based decision. And I was there last year. We had Obama, we had Bob Iger, and we had King Hussein of Jordan all there at the same time. And they were able to provide plenty of security for all of those very high-profile figures.
So you're thinking it's more, it's not really a security concern. That's not the number one reason why they canceled the speech.
Yeah, I think the security concerns can be addressed. You know, her speech, what she hadn't even prepared, she hasn't written it yet, but what she indicated is she was going to speak about hope and something uplifting and positive. But I think they might have feared her saying something in support of the Palestinian suffering that's being experienced in Gaza in particular, and they wanted to avoid the backlash. I know a number of other university presidents, they weren't perceived as standing strongly enough in handling protest speech. I think it's important to make a distinction between the criticism of a foreign government and anti-Semitism. I think sometimes the lines are blurred, but we should be able to, as people of conscience, stand up clearly and be critical of a foreign government and not be hate-filled, but be driven by love and desire to protect human life.
So, Rabbi Hieronsky, you know, it's an interesting question because one person's free speech is another person's hate speech in certain circumstances. Someone may be chanting Free Palestine and someone else may think that that is a threat to their existence. How do you navigate that? And this idea that, you know, behind some of these protests, there's the question of, is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? And how are you thinking about this right now?
In terms of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, these two terms can easily be blurred. We can speak critically of the Israeli government, and we can also speak positively of Israel as a nation. Many individuals, including Israelis themselves, have been protesting in the streets for weeks on end prior to October 7th as a way to express how they were feeling about their government. In terms of saying Free Palestine, that is not an anti-Semitic slur. The protests are saying things that are very different than that. They are indicating the end of peoplehood. They are suggesting a lot of the words coming out, not every human being, obviously, but many of the worms are words are directly anti-Semitic. So these are terms that are difficult, and these are about attacking human beings and not about, as the Imam was suggesting, coming together in spaces of love and care and recognizing that each human being is holy and deserving of space that is protected and cared for.
Okay, but given the reality on the ground that this is not happening, there's like tensions are running high on college campuses and elsewhere. How do we begin to try to lower the temperature? How do you reach across, I guess, and try to convince someone who has very passionately held beliefs that, for example, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea, and how some Jews and Israelis might view that. So how does one reach across and create common dialogue in this environment? And I'll just pose this to both of you, beginning with you, Rabbi.
In the actual inflamed environment, it is nearly impossible to have any kind of dialogue, any kind of shared communication or space. The more that people end up going back and forth, you're ending in places of shouting and violence. It is not a place where it's easy to ease tensions in any way, shape, or form. There is there are proverbs in our faith. There are teachings that say to engage a fool can make you into a fool. So that is when it's tricky. And to not engage a fool allows for non-truths, for misinformation to continue to spread. And so it's tricky to navigate. When do I choose to engage with somebody that is different than I am, that holds different views, and how can I do that thoughtfully and creatively? We're going to be doing it at our Seder tables. We have two nights of Sedering. And so during our Seder tables, we'll have people even around our own tables that disagree. How do I navigate in these spots?
Imam Turk?
I think there are two separate questions. One is, how do we connect with one another and actually listen and hear, do active listening, and can communicate what our fears and hopes are? I myself have convened the Greater Los Angeles Muslim Jewish Forum with Orthodox, conservative, reform rabbis here in the Los Angeles over the last 20 years. And we have off the record conversations in which we truly listen and understand one another and express our own narratives. And it's extremely meaningful. I think the challenge is when we go outside the closed door meetings in which we have everything off the record, and we try and compete for the public narrative and for the public sentiment that might influence policy and influence realpolitik, you know, how to navigate in that public discourse, I think, is where the challenge is. And that young people who feel a sense of urgency, an urgency of now, and they want change now. And so their passion on college campuses results in civil disobedience. And sometimes people cross the line, both in terms of what's legal and also what's moral, in terms of saying something offensive or that's even anti-Semitic. That is not the answer. The answer is, you know, to figure out how we can have a healthy public discourse and figure out what's in ultimately our not only national security interest, but in our human interest as human beings to support what is good and true and just and right in the world.
I want to thank you so much for your time and your thoughts today. And hopefully we can have a more peaceful future soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And if I could just say, maybe say one sentiment, I think it's important to note here. I have tremendous respect for Rabbi Sarah and the works that she's doing and the spiritual leadership that she's exerting to her community, because it's rooted in morality. And I think that that's one thing that religion really helps us to do, is to, even though we tend to be tribal as human beings, and sometimes we're religiously tribal, I think religion, when done right, helps us to go beyond our tribe and identify the humanity and the dignity of every human being. And so I think it's actually not a competition of suffering that we have between Muslims and Jews and others, but rather a calling from our religion to our higher selves to recognize the suffering that humanity faces and be sensitive to the call that we each have to protect human life and human dignity.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I believe that you can hold more than one truth simultaneously and be in a space where there's the possibility to coexist side by side, and actually a call and a drive. And for the Jewish people, preserving life is actually one of the highest, highest, truly the highest way of being, is to save a life. And so this is where we persist and endeavor in this season and in all seasons.
That's Imam Jihad Turk, founding president of the Bayan Islamic Graduate School, and Rabbi Sarah Horonsky of Temple Beth Hillel in Valley Village. Coming up, there are multiple problems at Tesla. Can the car company recover? And why the Los Angeles County Museum of Art is opening a satellite museum in Las Vegas? Those stories are next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tesla has hit some rocky terrain this month. The company has recalled nearly 4,000 Cybertrucks over faulty accelerator pedals. Truck owner Jose Martinez recorded the problem, and after he posted it on TikTok, it went viral.
It held the accelerator down 100%, full throttle, and holding the brake down overrides the pedal. So I was able to stop the car, but anytime I lift the brake, it would start accelerating again.
That is not Tesla's only problem. The company announced it'll lay off 10% of its workforce after sales fell during the first 3 months of this year. The stock price is down, and the CEO, Elon Musk, has alienated some potential buyers with his incendiary remarks on X, formerly Twitter. Joining us now is Tim Higgins, columnist for The Wall Street Journal and author of the book Power Play, Tesla, Elon Musk, and the Bet of the Century. Hello.
Hi.
All
nice
right.
To be here.
So it's great to have you. Lots of problems for Elon Musk and for Tesla. Let's begin with the Cybertruck. What happened?
Well, you know, an embarrassing start to a vehicle that is supposed to be a halo for the brand, is supposed to bring a lot of positive attention and get people excited about what Tesla could be. It is not a vehicle for the masses. It starts at around $100,000 currently, and it is hard to get a hold of. And so this kind of embarrassing stumble out of the gate is not the kind of thing you want to see in a vehicle that has been in the years of making, has been delayed many times. And it is just, as you said, one of the challenges Elon Musk is facing right now with Tesla after spending the last couple years seemingly being preoccupied, at least publicly, with Twitter turned X or all of the other companies that he has going for him.
Well, speaking of that, he's alienating some liberal buyers, apparently, with all of his postings on X and his cozying up to the far right. And so is he losing a key buyer demographic by being so incendiary on X/Twitter?
The interesting thing about electric cars in the United States is that they've become increasingly partisan. Democrats are the biggest cohort of people who buy electric cars. Republicans, not so much, in part because of the climate we are in. Republican candidates seeking the Republican nomination over the past year for the White House have made this a topic. Now, former President Donald Trump has made kind of his attacks against electric cars part of his routine stump speech, whereas the Biden administration is seen as supporting this technology and trying to kind of help it grow. And so you would think Tesla would want to appeal to Democrats, since those are the core buyers, and they traditionally have been the big buyers of it. But we've seen, especially in October and November of last year, the percentage of people, the mix of people buying the cars for Tesla, Democrats really turned away. We saw a big drop, a dramatic drop of Democrats turning away from Tesla. And that comes at a time when Elon was making a lot of public comments about illegal immigration, about kind of amplifying anti-Semitic vitriol on Twitter, and making kind of his big attacks against Disney and his kind of his idea that he thinks that they have become too woke.
And so in the meantime, he's not really picking up right-wing buyers either, because it appears that Democrats are, in general, more attracted to electric cars than Republicans.
Exactly. We've seen, if you look at the numbers, there was a slight uptick, but really the biggest mix during that kind of really contentious period were independents. Now Democrats have come back, at least the data shows from Strategic Vision, the surveys customers, that Democrats came back in the early part of this year, which kind of gets at this idea that if Elon can just not rock the boat too much, not make it all about himself out there, on these really contentious issues, that some people are willing to look at Tesla and buy them. Tesla is the dominant EV player in the U.S. They have been selling cars that people who maybe don't necessarily want an EV will turn to them. We like to say that people don't necessarily want an electric car, they want a Tesla vehicle. And that has really been the key to some of their success. So that's the question for the year ahead, is can Elon kind of do less Elon and let Tesla kind of stand on its own and do kind of the thing that it's done in the past.
So if you want one, let's say you want a Model Y, you can get one for a pretty good price now, because the company slashed prices.
Great time to buy. Great time to buy a Tesla, a Model Y right now. It is kind of a price war we're seeing among electric cars in the U.S. It's really a winter for the electric car industry right now. There was a lot of excitement in the last few years, a lot of euphoria around the idea that maybe this was the time when electric cars were going to start to really see monumental growth. And we've run into some kind of industry-wide challenges. These things oftentimes are more expensive. They don't have the same kind of performance as a gasoline-powered car. And some people just aren't ready to make the jump. But we are seeing increasingly huge increases in the sale of hybrid vehicles, the kind of Toyota Priuses of the world, which is more of an electrification of the automobile than we had a generation ago.
So if you wanted a Tesla, how much would it cost?
Well, if you go by the monthly payments, you could probably get one for around $300 a month, including all the tax credits here in California. You probably could get one all in around less than $30,000. And that's, a rather dramatic drop for a vehicle that on average was selling for $50,000 just a few years ago.
Amazing. Well, how big a threat is the Chinese company BYD? They're not selling here in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, they seem to be going gangbusters.
Massive threat to Tesla and Tesla's efforts to dominate the world. Remember, Elon Musk has this vision of turning Tesla into a car company that sells 20 million vehicles a year. That would be essentially roughly twice as many as Toyota, the current largest company automaker by sales. And BYD is the big threat to Tesla, especially in China, selling lower cost electric vehicles, really finding its niche, and more than a niche, if you will, a huge audience in China, increasingly in Europe, not in the U.S. yet, but they are definitely a threat. They are out there for them. So in a lot of ways, Tesla has, I like to think of a three-body problem here. They've got the threat of China, lower-cost EVs in that market. Here in the U.S., they've got the kind of the threat of the hybrid technology, which appeals to more mainstream customers. And then you've got Elon Musk himself, who is increasingly making contentious comments and doing erratic things that make a lot of drama around his companies, make it interesting to read him, but unnerve some buyers out there who just aren't sure they want to buy into his vision of the world.
Well, I guess his comments don't seem to be unnerving the board, which is asking shareholders to restore a $56 billion pay package for him, which a Delaware judge rejected earlier this year. Why are they rewarding him when the company's not doing so well?
Well, it gets to, it raises the question yet again of how impartial that board is. Remember, one of the board members is his brother. A number of the other board members have close business ties to Elon. And the criticism that occurred around that package, which originally was approved by shareholders in 2018, was that the company wasn't necessarily as transparent or didn't about kind of the terms behind how it was negotiated, that it was really not a good process. That was the judge's complaints. Essentially, what the board is trying to do is get shareholders to yet again approve it, hoping that this time it will stick. They want to move the companies from Delaware, its registration to Texas, where they think it'll be more of a business-friendly climate, really kind of doubling down on this pay package to Elon.
$56 billion. Wow. Okay. Boggles the mind. Tim Higgins, columnist for The Wall Street Journal, author of the book Power Play, Tesla, Elon Musk, and the Bet of the Century. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Press Play, we'll have a conversation with longtime foreign affairs correspondent David Sanger in his new book, The New Cold Wars. He says the United States missed the signs of Russia's discontent and China's rise. Coming up today, why the Los Angeles County Museum of Art director Michael Govan is opening a satellite museum in Las Vegas.
He's really looking at creating long-term deep relationships with all kinds of different partners, not just in the West, but again, globally.
That conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LACMA is opening up in Sin City. The LA Art Museum has signed on as a partner in the development of Las Vegas's only standalone art museum. So pieces from LACMA's collection will be on rotating loan in Vegas once the museum is complete. LACMA director Michael Govan sees this as an opportunity to expand the museum's reach and to display more of its artwork, which is in storage. Some critics, though, wonder why LACMA would partner with a city so far away. After all, the museum's name is the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Jessica Gelt covers art and culture for the LA Times and wrote about this planned expansion. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, I understand that LACMA has been trying to set up satellite campuses in Los Angeles for a while, and that has not been successful. So why did they decide to go to Vegas instead?
Well, apparently there was one in South LA that they had been working on that kind of went south during the pandemic, and they're hoping to get that one up and running again in time for the 2028 Olympics. But in the meantime, Las Vegas has been trying to get its own museum up and running, and Michael Govan saw this as sort of an opportunity to partner with them to expand the reach of LACMA and its art, and you know, to get its work out of storage. So it was going to happen, and he thought it would be an opportune time to partner.
And he has someone who is a willing partner in this, and that's Elaine Nguyen, who is the ex-wife of the casino magnate Steve Nguyen. She's an art collector, and she also happens to sit on the LACMA board. Was she the guiding person in all this?
Well, I think she absolutely had something to do with it and had some sway. I think it was sort of a collaborative agreement between parties, including Heather Harmon, who's the executive director of the Vegas Museum. And as you point out, Elaine Nguyen is co-chair of the LACMA board, but she also sits on the Vegas board, as does Michael Govan. So, you know, the boards are intertwined. And in my interview, I did ask Michael if, you know, that would present a conflict of interest. But since the Las Vegas Museum is not intending to be a collecting institution of any kind, he said that there won't be any conflicts because, you know, nobody will be deciding where to give art to.
Is his whole idea that, oh, there's all this art sitting in storage and it deserves to be seen by the public? Is that one of the reasons?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. And he talked about kind of a 21st century paradigm for modern museums. And he said that, rather than enlarging a physical footprint, that, you know, LACMA should broaden its cultural influence. He said it was a 20th century idea to keep adding wings until, you know, you're a million square feet on Fifth Avenue, obviously referencing the Met. But he said the 21st century idea is to build infrastructure in other communities and long-term relationships. So he's calling that kind of a paradigm shift. And he's been wanting to do that in Los Angeles for quite some time. And now seeing this opportunity with Las Vegas, he called it a sister city and said that it was like the natural next step in that evolution of thinking.
Okay, so what are the critics saying? And you have ones that is in your on your paper in the name in the form of Christopher Knight, the art critic. And he seems to be really against this idea. So what is he and what are others saying about this?
Yeah, so you know when the plan was first announced in late December and January, a lot of people were chiming in online saying, you know, why should LA County subsidize Clark County? And then when my story ran, Christopher Knight, art critic, ran a piece of commentary alongside it, basically calling it just a terrible idea. And he said that these kinds of satellites dilute the powerful experience of a global art museum to questionable effect. And he also said that he felt like, you know, it was sort of a lose-lose proposition because he was questioning if we're sending from Los Angeles a bunch of our best art to Las Vegas, then Los Angeles residents are missing out. And if instead we're sending second-tier art to Las Vegas, then Las Vegas residents are missing out. And he just said, you know, that basically it was just a completely misguided idea, and, you know, should not be embarked upon at all.
Right. And then he also made the point that museums, their primary purpose is not to show art to the public, but to conserve art. And that by taking it out of storage, you could really damage some of these delicate pieces of art.
Yes, I thought that was a really interesting thing that he was talking about. He said, you know, that one of Govan's ideas is that, you know, we need to take the art out of storage. It shouldn't be sitting in storage. But yeah, you're right. He pointed out that a lot of the stuff in storage is extremely light sensitive. It's very delicate. It belongs in storage. So, you know, he's saying that too is perhaps not the best excuse for this kind of a satellite activity.
And did you pose any of these objections to Michael Govan when you talked to him? And if so, what was his response?
Yeah, and he was very adamant that there was no, there would be no conflict of interest between the two museums in any way, shape, or form, and that loss money from LA County would not in any way be going to Clark County, and that it was a win-win. He basically said that for him, when he's trying to get people to donate or give art to LACMA, they'll ask where that art will be seen. And if the more places he's able to list, including Las Vegas and other regional partners in Los Angeles County, the more eager people are to donate. And he said that he's tested the proposition and that it's true. So, you know, he felt that this kind of an agreement would actually help him shore up an even better collection for Los Angeles County.
What is happening in the meantime with the expansion on the primary campus, the Wilshire Boulevard redesign, rebuild, expansion? What's going on with that building?
You know, if you drive by that site, you will be surprised. I mean, it's really coming along. It pushed through a $750 million fundraising campaign and is currently, Michael told me during our interview a few months ago, hurtling, heading, inching towards $800 million. And it should be up and running by 2026. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether it will. It's had a lot of delays, but that's the idea currently.
This is something that Christopher Knight, the art critic there, also doesn't like.
Yes. Well, his problem is he says that the new David Geffen galleries actually have less space for the permanent collection than the original building, and that this idea of rotating the collection during themed exhibits rather than, you know, having it more steadily on view is also misguided and doesn't make sense.
But anyway, this expansion continues apace and will likely be completed by the time the Olympics roll into town.
Yeah, even before, hopefully. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good news, I guess.
I think so. I think people will, you know, it'll it, I think it'll people will be happy to be able to go there.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone likes a shiny new museum. All right. So Michael Govan sees the future of art museums as having satellite campuses. Does he see anything beyond Las Vegas? Does he see any more LACMA satellite campuses?
He's talking about sort of expanding the reach of LACMA in the West, but also globally with global partnerships. But he didn't speak of those in other countries as satellites necessarily. But I think he's really looking at creating long-term deep relationships with all kinds of different partners, not just in the West, but again, globally. So he's thinking quite expansively in terms of, what LACMA can accomplish and how it can be perceived in the art world.
Jessica Gelt writes about art and culture for the Los Angeles Times. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me again.
John Lithgow has had a long and successful career as an actor. Recently, though, he went back to school here in L.A. to learn how to sing and dance and do ceramics. His teachers were high school students. What he learned is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. John Lithgow has been an actor for more than five decades. He earned Oscar nominations for The World According to Garp and Terms of Endearment, portrayed a memorable minister and father opposed to dancing in Footloose. He won three Emmys for Third Rock from the Sun and critical acclaim and more Emmys for his work on The Crown and Dexter. He really credits his career to the art teachers who nurtured him as a boy. And now he's paying homage to them in a new PBS special.
In the last few years, an idea has taken hold in my mind, an urge to showcase arts in education, to celebrate great teachers, and to share my belief in the essential role that arts play in educating all young people. So I ventured back to school to experience the power of the arts at four locations in Los Angeles.
The show is called Art Happens Here with John Lithgow, who joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. I feel welcome.
You are welcomed. What were these four locations and how did you choose them?
They were LACSA, the LA County High School of the Arts. They were the Community Center Ceramic Studio in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. They were the great self-help graphics in Boyle Heights, the sort of center of the Chicano arts community. And finally, the great Debbie Allen Dance Academy, created and run by my old friend, Debbie Allen, where in fact, I had taken ballet classes once about 20 years ago, preparing to dance with the New York City Ballet.
Wow.
That's another story.
And how did you choose these four? I mean, maybe you chose Debbie Allen because you knew her, but how did you choose the other three?
I came up with this idea of going back to school in four different areas of the arts. I and my two producers, we had a wonderful time spitballing, trying to decide what it is I would try to do that I wasn't already good at. And we came up with silkscreen printmaking, ceramics, a vocal jazz ensemble, and Catherine Dunham dance. And in the process of making those choices, we did a lot of research about the different educational institutions around Los Angeles.
Okay. Well, speaking of singing, I do have a clip of tape from the movie. And this is you trying to sing at LACSA. You're performing with a jazz ensemble.
Snowflakes. Whisper, snowflakes, whisper.
That one was a little late.
I'm just screwing up on purpose. Just right.
So there's the instructor, Pat Bass, helping you out there. And it does seem that of all of the different disciplines, this one was the most difficult for you to master. How did you feel about it?
Yes, it was. I actually done quite a lot of singing as an actor. I've done a lot of musical theater, but I never, well, look, to a certain degree, I went into all of these projects willing and almost interested in failing to be bad at it. But indeed, I was very self-conscious. And when you're self-conscious singing, you sound completely awful. But when I said, I'm doing this, I'm just screwing up on purpose, there was a degree of truth in that. The whole idea was for the kids to be better at this than I was.
Mm-hmm. How did the kids take to you being in class with them?
They were just wonderful. All the kids were at all these different schools. I was a novelty. They didn't really, a lot of them, most of them, I would say, had no idea who I was until they heard the word Shrek. When they heard that I was the voice of Lord Farquaad, I suddenly was a big deal. But on the other hand, that was just my voice.
Right.
So I sort of had to prove that I was an interesting person. But they loved their teachers. I mean, the whole piece is basically celebrating art teachers, and these four art teachers in particular were all wonderful. And so they felt that they were sort of companion in arms with these teachers. The teachers taught them and they taught me. And they really liked that dynamic. They loved being better at something than a 78-year-old man.
And how did you feel about that, being, you know, because you are obviously, you're a celebrated actor, as I said in the intro, so you have mastered that discipline. And also you say in the movie that you are an inveterate sketcher and drawer, so, and you're great at that. So how did it feel not to be good at something?
Oh, I sulked the entire time.
Did you? No.
No, not at all. I mean, that was sort of the idea. The whole idea was for me to take myself out of my comfort zone, to be the new kid in school, which I was several times when I was a kid, because I went to lots of different public schools. In a sense, I was trying to create the childhood experience in myself. The whole idea of this documentary is to try to capture the collaboration, the interaction between a great teacher and a willing student. So I just sort of, I was kind of playing that role, but I was playing it for real because I just put myself into a documentary setting.
And where did you grow up?
Well, four places in Ohio, three in Massachusetts. I graduated from Princeton High School. I was in a theater family. It was a kind of gypsy wagon childhood. And I would say, interestingly enough, it was all public schools that I went to as a kid, but I had some wonderful art instruction, particularly in the city of Akron, Ohio, in 9th and 10th grade, where I have no idea why, but the Akron school system was very interested in kids getting great art instruction. I began every school day with two periods of studio art. And at that time in my life, I was quite interested in being an artist. So in many ways, that experience as just an adolescent inspired this thing that I've done like 60 years later.
And is it also, it also seems to me a plea for people not to ignore the arts or underfund the arts or cut arts programming from public schools.
Very much so. It's not just a plea. It's a sort of cry for help. I really do think that arts and education is desperately important. It's something that has suffered over the last many years. It was understood to be a big part of a kid's education when I was a kid. And not anymore. So, yes, the whole show is a piece of arts advocacy, but I'm an entertainer. So my strategy was to make it as entertaining as possible, but to make that point very, very strongly. This is important. It's important for kids, particularly in the wake of the pandemic, when millions of kids have been deprived of 2 years of social development and in-person education, I just thought it was important to make a strong case for giving kids a terrific outlet for their creative selves and give them things that make them eager to get back to school again every morning.
How do you see that playing out against the backdrop here in Los Angeles of Hollywood and the fact that, I don't know, in a large portion of the city, the arts mean one thing, and that is the movies. You did not focus on the movies in this. Like, I know Loxa has a movie making program, but you went to the music section of it. So was that on purpose that you didn't want to look at the movies because, well, you're a movie star and that's such a big focus in Los Angeles?
Not really. That's an interesting question, Madeline. I really never gave much thought to it, mainly because I think even if you want to be a filmmaker, it's very, very important that you learn about much more than filmmaking. I think young people should have access and choices among all the arts, for sure. But I just think that, I don't know, there's something so basic about learning to draw, learning to read music, learning to get a sense of rhythm and shape. And I didn't think much about Los Angeles. I thought a lot about California, because while we were doing the show, Prop 28 was on, right? The campaign to pass Prop 28, Austin Buettner's initiative to raise literally $1 billion to add to the, or to take from the education budget of California public education and devote it to expanding art programs and hiring more art teachers and training more art teachers. You know, to that extent, you know, I thought a lot about what's going on in California, but I didn't think about the movie business at all. Funny you didn't mention that. It was my way of getting away from the movie business for a while.
Right. So how did you fit this in? Because here you are in one of the biggest movies of the year, Killers of the Flower Moon, and you're working a lot.
I'm working way, way too much. It took a long time. It was a challenge finding that little moment between jobs when I could hurl myself into this. It took about 4 weeks in November and December of, I think, 2023. And it just timed out fine. And, you know, it didn't take a huge... Everybody else was putting in a lot of time on preparation. All I had to do was show up and be a great big fool, you know, plunge myself into it.
Yeah, but still, there's some whiplash there, right? From being, on a movie set to then being in a classroom or in a community space in East Los Angeles.
It was more fun than you can imagine. So much of it had to do with the kids. We found very quickly who the special kids were, and they sort of emerged as the major voices in the piece. Four of them in the vocal jazz ensemble, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, who took me aside and coached me. But then there's this wonderful young gal, Yoli, who was a silkscreen expert, a young woman named Estrella at the Debbie Allen Dance Academy. In each case, I would go to a class with several kids. We would pick one we would call the alpha student, and I would go back and get a one-on-one tutorial from a child. The fourth of this group was a young woman named Rosie, who sort of gave me specialized training in ceramics. It was absolutely wonderful to see the sort of teaching skills of young people emerge. The beautiful thing was teachers teaching students and students teaching me and finding out something in themselves that they didn't even know they were good at.
Yeah. And you seem like a really good student too, willing to learn. So that's good too, especially, you know, most people at this stage of life think they've learned what they need to know.
Well, I'm an inveterate learner. I mean, that one nice thing about being an actor is you get a chance to try all sorts of things in your life. This was just a way of sort of ramping that up.
Well, John Lithgow, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about art.
You know, this was on my bucket list, Madeline. I've always wanted to talk to you. This was great.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Art Happens Here with John Lithgow premieres Friday, April 6th on PBS. We'll be right back. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Join us tomorrow. We'll have a conversation with foreign policy expert David Sanger on what he calls the new Cold Wars with China and Russia. And also our favorite, Evan Kleiman, will be with us to talk about how to cook a spring legume, fava beans. That's all coming up on tomorrow's show. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening today, and I will see you again tomorrow.